Hello, world. Welcome to WFHR's Director's Cut for this July 7th, 2024, session 47. Your host and program director here, James J. Mailoff. I'm joined by my partner in art, our head of production, Seth Habhager. Seth, Mike's on. Let's roll.
Let's do it. You know, this is kind of a fun episode because we're doing something that we kind of were talking about many, many years ago about possibly doing a podcast about movies called But I Digress. And we're kind of coming full circle now. We're doing something similar, not exactly the same, but we're doing something similar for the show today.
I've always loved this idea. I know that you and I have wanted to do it for a long time.
Yep.
And here we are. We're finally able to.
We finally get to do it.
I do want to note to the audience that this is kind of something that Seth and I are going to probably do a little bit more of.
Yeah.
As we are in between guests, we will kind of keep creating content for you.
Yeah.
And I want to give Seth credit for this because, honestly, I was busy trying to book guests and different things, and I was not thinking about that as much. And I appreciate that note, man. It keeps it's the way to keep this show alive, not only alive, but successful, is continually having new content. So we're looking forward to this.
Simplifying it sometimes helps out.
And I want to let the audience know that while these are movies that Seth and I picked out, we'd love you to pick out a movie that you'd like us to review or feature or anything like that. And the more obscure, the better. The more niche, the better. We love those. But we'll do it with any movie. I don't care
pretty
what
much,
it is.
Yeah.
Email either of us, james.mailoff@civicmedia.us, seth.habhager@civicmedia.us. You can reach out to any of us anytime. We'd love to hear from you. And we'd love to review your shows. Keep those email addresses handy, too, because we want your guests. We want you entertainers, you creatives out there.
Yeah.
Get on the show. You could be here.
As a matter of fact, if you want to just come on the show and talk about a movie like we're doing right now, hey, we'll do that too. We'd love to. If you're just, you're not an artist or anything, but you love movies, come on to the show. We'd love to talk to you.
Before we dive into the movies, I do think that for this episode, it should be Director's Cut, But I Digress. But I think that each one of these
we'll
should
have to
be
put that
labeled
in the podcast,
that.
Yeah.
I did want to start off as something that Seth and I really like to do. I don't know if we set out to do this, but we've kind of continued to do this on the show where we shout out great character actors that we have lost. It's something that you and I have consistently done on this show. And for those that didn't hear, we recently lost an amazing veteran actor, Bill Cobbs. Bill was one of those actors that you know him if you saw him.
Absolutely.
Over 200 film and TV credits in his career.
That's a working actor right there.
Yeah. I think a lot of people remember him from The Bodyguard or Night at the Museum. He had an amazing role in New Jack City. He was in Air Bud. He was in a bunch of those movies. If you are looking for a movie to highlight Cleveland's own Mr. Bill Cobbs and you're looking for a great performance, if I can recommend a movie that might even be featured on this show sometime, a sneaky underrated movie, The Hudsucker Proxy.
Oh, my gosh.
It is such an amazing performance by Bill Cobbs. And while Tim Robbins does an amazing job in that, as he does in almost everything I've ever seen him in, Bill Cobbs, I think, steals the scenes that he is in.
That's awesome.
And he is one of those character actors that I love that could do that. Not every character actor could pull that off. Bill Cobbs was one of those guys that was, I wouldn't say do this a lot, but when the moment shined for him, he took it.
And that's, you know, being an actor who works constantly, you know, big things, small things, it doesn't matter. You're just working. You're constantly honing, you know, you're constantly working and at your craft and all these kinds of things. And those are probably the best people when they get that chance, you know, a little bit bigger role or something. They're the ones that can just nail it because they're just, it's right there. They can do it.
I've had the debate with many actors and even comedians and some others about this. It's actually often musicians that'll bring this one up. If you could have, for broad examples, James Dean career or Bill Cobb's career, where you're one of the most famous actors of all time, even to this day. James Dean ain't done a movie in 40 years.
Icon.
But still an icon. But he did three films. Or would you rather have a Bill Cobbs career where you have 200 movies and you work for such a long time and everything? And I have never blinked at this question once. Give me Bill Cobbs' career every time.
Absolutely.
I'm a big James Dean guy, so I wasn't me picking on James Dean. It's just a matter of I got into this not to be well known. I got into this to be good at it. I got into this to work with other people that are good at it. it and want to make good creative work.
Absolutely.
I think that's the art of that one of the greatest notes you could say to an actor is you did good work. You were a part of good projects.
I mean, and even if it's a, you know, like maybe it seems like it's silly on the surface, like Air Bud or something like that, you know, kind of a movie is like, oh, why did you do that? Well, it was a job. You know, work, man. That's what you do. That is your job. And I think this is a lot of people kind of get hung up on because of the fame. And sometimes if you're really good, you know, you get a lot of money if you're a good entertainer or a sports person.
Yeah.
You know, which James and I consider entertainers.
Yes.
It's like, you know, well, why did you take that movie? Why did you do that? It's my job, man.
Yeah.
This is what I do. Now, a lot of people enjoy movies. And that's cool. You know, people come to see them, and that's why we do the job that we do. But it's still a job.
Yeah.
You're still a worker. You got to keep that in mind.
I appreciate also being able to do this, to be able to take these notes and be able to shout them out.
Yeah.
It's always fun. I want to, and I think that while we're talking about character actors, there are not character directors, but there are directors who are a bit more okay with being behind the scenes, not being the big name, not having to have their name ahead of the credits. There are directors who really are about the project, are about the work. And I think our first director that we're going to feature, our first film we're featuring, in John Cassavetes is one of those great examples of that.
Right. So if it's a name you're not familiar with, John Cassavetes was a independent film director for many years in the 60s, 70s, 80s. I don't have when he passed away. He passed away pretty young, though, unfortunately.
1989. Or no, I'm sorry. 1989.
So he was not very old when he passed away. Now, if you know John Cassavetes, the actor, he was in a couple of pretty darn big movies. I believe he was in The Dirty Dozen.
Dirty Dozen.
He plays the husband in Rosemary's Baby. Does a
That's
great
right.
job in that
yes,
movie.
Yes.
And a couple of other big roles and stuff. But he was one of those guys. He did the acting to pay for the films. Now, he was a very independent filmmaker. He was known for basically early in his career, he did black and white, very, I guess you could say, kind of claustrophobic movies. They were very, like in tight situations. The relationships were very close, and that's kind of where he got the drama from. So his first big film was Shadows, which kind of hit the indie scene, and people were starting to go crazy about it. He did a film called Husbands. He did a film called, probably one of his more famous ones, is A Woman Under the Influence,
yes.
which actually starred his wife, Gina Roland.
Maybe my
fabulous actor, yeah. And probably his most well-known, but through the 60s and the 70s, the early 70s, he was known for these really intense, emotional, relationship-driven movies. That's what he was known for. And in 1975, 76, he decides to take a complete left turn and do what's considered a neo-noir called The Killing of a Chinese Bookie. Now, not that John Cassavetes as a director was a household name. He wasn't. But in the industry, this was like, whoa, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. This is something he's never done before.
Yeah.
But as you watch the movie, and if you've seen some of his other movies, it's very similar in terms of what he's trying to get across. All of his stuff is about relationships. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's the relationship of a man who owns kind of like a strip club, burlesque house kind of thing. It's called Crazy Horse West, named after, of course, the famous Crazy Horse in Paris. And it's not like just, you know, people, ladies coming out and bumping and grinding and kind of thing. It's a show. They have props and they do songs. And so it's a little different from your, you know, a normal everyday thing. Cosmo Vitelli is the name of the main character, played by the great, underrated Ben Gazzara.
Yeah.
Who, you've heard the name before. He kind of broke out with Anatomy of a Murder.
Yeah.
That was his first big role. Extremely handsome man.
Yes.
I mean, yes. Even as he got older, in this film, he's in his 40s.
He's a little older in this,
my God, is he handsome. Man.
Yeah.
he plays, you know, the owner of this club. And basically the plot, such as it is he gets out of, you know, he's in debt. He finally pays off his loan shark to get all of this. He celebrates by taking some of his girls, some of his dancers, and he goes out and goes to an illegal gambling thing. He does play poker, immediately goes in over his head. He's down $23,000. And this was the 70s. That's not nothing.
Yeah.
Especially for a small-time operator like him. So he has to go in and talk to the guys running the game. Yeah, they're gangsters. They're, you know, they're not like mafia. You know, they're just like small-time hoods kind of thing. But they've got a lot of money and influence. So he's got to make good on it. So what does he do? He signs, basically signs over the club to them. So if anything happens to him, they get ownership of the club. Okay. So, and they're like, well, if we ever call on you to do us a favor, you're good. You know, don't worry about it. So he goes on about his business, but very quickly they come see him at his club and say, hey, we got something we need you to do. Mm-hmm. And basically it says, we got this Chinese bookie over in Chinatown. This is, takes place in LA, by the way. You need to take care of him for us. Mm-hmm. Go and, you know, shoot him, basically. Yeah, yeah. And so he's, at first he's very reluctant. He's like, no. Well, we'll figure something else out. You know, I'll pay you back, but we'll do this. Basically, they say, no, you're going to do this for us because we want you to do it. Yeah. It's basically a setup for him. And I, without getting too much into the plot, he goes in and does the thing. He actually accomplishes what they send him to do, which is not what they wanted. And that's kind of where the movie goes from there.
Yeah.
Again, the plot is, especially in a lot of John Cassavetes movies, is not the most important thing. It's the relationship that they have. And I really want to point out a couple of really interesting things. Now, the version that I saw was the 78 director's cut.
Yeah.
So when the movie was released in 1976, it was a little bit longer than he normally did. And Ben Gazzara, the star, saw it, and he was, you know, he was friends with Cassavetes, and he said, I don't think it's that good. He said, there's something about it I don't like. So Cassavetes went back and recut the entire movie. And he didn't just, you know, like cut parts out. He like rearranged it and he changed it so he thought it could be better. That's the version I saw. I have not seen the original version, so I don't know the differences. And but from the sounds of it, there's quite a few. Hmm. A lot of the musical strip numbers were kind of cut out of the new one. You still get a couple of them and that kind of thing. But a couple of things that really struck me about this movie. First of all, the camera. For those who know John Cassavetes, he was interested in close-ups.
Yes.
He wants to get his actors, he wants to get every little nuance of their reaction and everything. One of the best scenes, or one of the most striking scenes, I should say, he is, Cosmo is in a diner, and the gangster guys are all around him. He's kind of in the middle. There's like four of them, and they're all talking about what they want him to do, mm-hmm. go and kill this bookie. And the whole thing is shot in close-up. Handheld camera, it goes back between the people speaking, but the acting is so good. You get to see these reactions. You read on their face what they're feeling. And, man, there's nothing. It's an intense scene because they're asking him to go and kill somebody. He was in Korea, you know, so he was a combat vet. He had shot people, but in a war kind of scenario. Right. So this is completely different. Mm-hmm. That's one of the most striking things about that is the close-ups and the emotion of the scene, him really not wanting to do this, realizing he's stuck because he signed the paper, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other striking scene, one of the other striking scenes is, so he's going now, he is going to go to Chinatown, go to kill the guy, okay? There's a plan, they give him the plan, the gangsters say, okay, you're going to do this and this and this and this, and there you go. They give him a car that was stolen, he drives, he gets a flat.
Oh.
So right off the bat, something bad happens.
Yeah.
Okay, so he gets to a gas station and he calls a cab in a phone booth. Immediately afterwards, he calls the club, and he's asking the bartender and everyone else there who will talk to him how the show's going, and it's not going the way he thinks it should be going.
Sonny, how's it going? Well, who's on stage? Margot and Sherry. Yeah, why are only two girls on stage? Where's Teddy? He just came on. All right, well, what's he singing? What song is he singing, Sonny? But how can that be... Sonny, how can that be the song with only two girls on stage? What? Sonny! Well, who's this? Vince, I can't understand Sonny. Who's on stage now? The short girl, Margot Donna, right? And the tall girl, right? Sherry. Yeah. And what number is it? Is it the Paris number? The Paris number, for Christ's sake. You've been at the place 7 years. You don't know what the Paris number is? Well, are there signs on the wall? P-A-R... The Paris number. Are there letters on the wall that say P-A-R? There's another card that says Moon. Well, what's he singing? Is it I can't give you anything but love, baby? I can't give you anything but love, baby.
The striking thing about this scene, he's in the middle of going to kill somebody, but the most important thing to him is that the show is going right. And he's not there to control it. And it's driving him crazy. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. What's important to this guy? It's not that he's got to go kill somebody. Mm-hmm. It's that the show isn't going right.
Yeah.
And I'm not there to fix it. And I can't stand that. I'm not there to control it.
It's a really intense scene.
And again, it's like a lower angle close-up of him in the phone booth. It's very claustrophobic, but it's so indicative of the character. You get to know who Cosmo is and what's very important to him.
I've seen a lot of modern directors and even 90s directors, aughts directors, talk about his work. And even a lot of directors of the late 60s, 70s, they got away from a lot more makeup in that time. And in part because they wanted to do more close-ups. They wanted to do more of, I want to see the sweat on your brow.
Realistic.
I want more of that. He was really one of the guys that really helped get that going to where we are now, where we see a lot more of that. And we've kind of gone back to a lot more of that.
It makes it very unglamorous.
Yeah.
The whole movie has kind of a, and I think intentionally, kind of a grimy feel to it.
It feels
so lived in. It feels so real that you totally believe that all these, you know, people. One, a great example. I love this. You never see this in a mainstream movie, okay? So he, at one point, he's auditioning a new dancer. And one of the other dancers comes in, who's actually his girlfriend, and she's jealous and she's very upset that he's alone auditioning this dancer to be a stripper, of course. And this stripper freaks out, you know, because the woman comes after her a little bit and she's, you know, half naked. She's grabbing her clothes. She's running to the door. Okay. Two things happen as she's running to the door that you would see. If that happened in a regular movie set on a, like a thing, the director would immediately call cut and do the scene again. She's running. She drops her shirt. And she stops, turns around, and picks it up again. She gets to the door while she's like trying to put her shirt on and all these kinds of things. She grabs the door, pulls. It doesn't open. Pulls it again and opens it and then leaves the scene. That's the end of that little scene there. Those two things, her going back to get her shirt and her not opening the door on the first try, in a mainstream movie, never see it.
Yeah.
You would never see that because it's like, no. It's got to look, you know, there's a beat and rhythm and all these kinds of things.
In time.
And yeah, one right. Put exactly. Time into it. But Cassavetes kept it in. He's like, that's what I want. That's what I, it's those kind of little, like, quote unquote, mistakes that makes it feel so real. Because, yeah, that would happen. If you're rushing to get out, you're half naked, you're trying to get dressed, and you drop stuff and the door won't open and all these kinds of things, it makes it. For other things that make it, you know, kind of questions like, wait a minute, will this really happen kind of thing in that movie? But those little things there, man, it makes it so, it really pulls you in.
Everybody has had that moment where you're storming off and the door won't open, or you try to, you try to slam the door, but it doesn't shut all the way, or something gets stuck in the door as you're trying to make this big dramatic exit or something like that. That's reality. And audiences, even going back to the 60s, have wanted that more and more from their films. I think that we have gotten much better at that, at doing that. But I think there are parts that we have lost. The grittiness that you're talking about in part is done by great camera work and great props people and set design and a lot of that. But also the way that it was, the film that we had back then. We only had such good film. We only were able to film things a certain way. So I think that with the modern times being what they are, and on our phones, we can film major pictures now.
And it looks great, right?
Yeah. We've lost a little of that griminess that we could create in those scenarios.
Right.
There is parts of that. Cassavetes also, I do want to note here, the actor that he was. When you brought this up, I hadn't seen the film, and I went back and I had seen the film. I just forgot about the film, and I had to go back and see some scenes. But what you did for me, too, I love The Dirty Dozen. I watch it all the time with my dad. There is a great film, if I could just piggyback off of your suggestion.
Absolutely.
Mickey and Nicky.
Yes.
Probably my favorite when I think of him. And honestly, when I think of Peter Falk, it's one of the first things. I don't think of Columbo right away. I think of that performance. I think of that film. He loved relationships. the plot of the movie was only the plot of the movie for the audience.
Yeah.
For him, especially as an actor, it was the relationships. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why he worked with I think a credit to an actor is oftentimes noted in the people that they work with, mm-hmm. and that you see them work with again and again and again. And him and Peter Falk had great chemistry.
They did.
Were good friends and worked really well together. And that movie, while they did a lot of things together, mm-hmm. and stuff, and not even saying it's the greatest project either of them did, whether together, right. or solo, it's such a good example of why we like these guys, why they continue to work and doing real work. There's so many mob movies out there, and so yeah. many of them are really caricatures of other mob movies.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
This is an original mob tale.
Yes.
It's an original one. If you really, and I think actually knowing a little bit about this, mm-hmm. stuff actually gives you a little more insight into that world than most movies do.
Right. It shows you the criminal mastermind. No. Okay. It shows the mob guys. They're not that smart. You know, they're opportunists. They see opportunities to get, you know, stuff to make money. That's the reason they're doing all these things. The main reason they set up Cosmo is they want to kill him so they can take over his club. Yeah. That's why they do it. So they set up this whole elaborate thing. And that's where part of the unbelievability of the plot itself, sure. it gets into. But you don't care about that. You just care about what's going to happen next. What is Cosmo going to do? And these kinds of things. And the whole time you're enjoying these relational things that Cassavetes is bringing out in this. And a lot of it was improvised by the actors.
Yeah.
You know, Cassavetes, being an actor himself, understood this. And you know, the script was rewritten every day,
yes.
and that kind of thing. There's not a ton of dialogue. I mean, there is, but there's a lot of quiet parts where it's just I noticed the sound design was amazing in this movie. There's a part where Cosmo is going in to do the deed and stuff like that. There's no sound except for here and there.
Yeah.
They put sounds in there. Oh, it's great. It's noticeable. But you notice it and it's like, wow, that is so cool that he decided, yep, he's using all of the cinematic arts in this movie to make it really memorable, which is what he, in my opinion, has succeeded.
If it wasn't for acting, I think that if I was going to get into something in the creative realm and film and TV and everything, I would have been an editor.
Mm-hmm.
I really love it. Or maybe a photographer. I really love film photography. I love the great work that so many of our great cameramen have done over decades.
Absolutely,
and everything.
Yeah.
But editing, to me, there's something about just a clean, great, flawless edit,
mm-hmm.
That gets me every single time, no matter how many times I see it. This was another one of those guys that editing was incredibly important. And part of that
Absolutely.
Was because of something you touched on there that I have in my notes too, Seth, the sound. Not just the sounds that we hear, but the lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you could... I understand that most of you haven't been on a film set or a TV set or anything.
Sure, yeah.
And you're not really that, but you're kind of better for it in some ways. But one thing that every set I have been on, and I've been on about 16, 17 sets, so mm-hmm. I haven't been on that many, but whether it's a TV show or a movie, whether I have a good part or I don't, or a big part or I don't, the same thing, the tension. There is a tension on every set I've ever been on, because while even if the cameras aren't running, the money is running.
The register is always going, right?
And there is somebody, whether it's a producer or somebody or a director or somebody out there thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh, we got to go. We the film's rolling. We got to go. Cameras are rolling. Even if they're not technically rolling, that's what they'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And that phrase is still being used a lot. So the idea of at a time when there's not a big budget in this film, there's not a lot, there is that pressure there,
mm-hmm.
and you're still able to have that calm, those moments where some of the most dramatic things you've ever seen or ever experienced,
mm-hmm.
are silent. Nobody's talking. Nothing's being said. That's such there's such a danger in that. Whether we're talking about in radio and letting there be dead air, or we're talking about film and TV,
mm-hmm.
where, again, the cameras are rolling. This is costing money.
Yep.
How dare you have a scene where your actors aren't speaking?
Mm-hmm.
But we go right back to the reality. And how much people want reality in their films and their movies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how many times have you been in a moment where somebody in the room says something dramatic or something heavy, and you didn't just immediately say something?
Right.
You thought about it. You felt it. You felt it in the room.
Mm-hmm.
In this movie in particular of his, you get feelings where you feel like you're in that club.
Yeah.
You really do. I didn't remember that as a kid until I was rewatching some
right,
of it.
Right. And then I think that's just to say how specific a filmmaker John Cassavetes was. Now, I'm going to say right now, it's probably not for everyone. I don't like saying that because I think if you get into the right headspace, you can watch any movie.
Yeah.
You really can. And maybe it's not the best movie. It's not the best movie ever. I can tell you that right now. But it's still, there's a fascination in there of all kinds of these things coming together, which for John Cassavetes, film was art. Period. That was it. For him, when he was making a movie, it was art, art, art. He didn't care if anyone watched it. He made movies for himself. That was his expression. That's how he expressed himself as an artist. And so that's what you're getting. You're getting what John Cassavetes wants to put out there. Now, it's not like he wasn't a collaborator. He was. He made his actors do lots of work, and that's how they got to the point where they did. A couple real quick things before I wrap it up. I do want to say there's a couple of performances in this that are really good. First of all, Ben Gazzara, amazing.
Yeah.
He's a character that Cosmo is not someone you're terribly sympathetic to. He's caught in his own little world. Yeah. He gets out of his world and he's kind of lost, that kind of thing. But you do. There is sympathy for him. And that's, I think, because of how good of an actor Ben Gazzara is.
Yeah.
One guy that I don't think ever got his due when he was alive, sadly. You know, he did some other great things. He's the villain in Roadhouse, the best bad movie ever made.
Yes.
So I want to point that out. Also, Seymour Castle, speaking of character actors, Seymour Castle, who was another one of those guys, 200 movies kind of thing, working actor for 40 years, something like that. You'd see him. He's got his voice, especially.
Yes.
You will know who he is. I'm trying to think of a movie where people would remember him. If you remember Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
He played one of Dick Tracy's lieutenants, Sam Ketchum.
That was right.
Seymour Castle.
Yeah.
You know, he usually had a mustache, but he shaved it for that one kind of thing. But his voice, you'll know his gravelly voice. He is very good in this as well. He was one of Cassavetes' stock guys. He was in almost all of his movies because he was good. And he's very good in this as one of the gangsters kind of thing. So, I mean, and all I can say is that, you know, it's one of those movies, you know, you're in the right mindset. Check it out kind of thing. It's a little, I think, more accessible than other of Cassavetes' movies because of the crime angle that makes people, you know, more accessible to people, that kind of thing. And I have to go back and check. Apparently, this is when David Bowie was living in L.A., and he was really fascinated by Cassavetes as a filmmaker. Some of the crowd shots of the club, he's in some of those.
Wow.
I have been told. Now, I haven't checked that out, but so if you do decide to watch it, see if you can find David Bowie in some of the crowd shots at the club.
I'm glad you brought up the I'm glad you brought up this director, this actor, this movie in particular. This is a great first one to really get this whole thing started. It's a perfect example of what we talk about. And I'm really thankful that you brought up the idea of if it's a good movie or not. Everybody,
so subjective.
it so much is.
Yeah.
And I think that's all the more reason to suggest movies, whether it's to us on this show or it's to friends and such. You just don't know what somebody might enjoy or somebody might not.
Absolutely.
And I admit I'm walking into this a little biased. I have never seen I've never wasted my time with a movie. I've seen plenty of bad movies, but I've never come out of it and thought, oh, that's 2 hours. I'll never get back.
Right.
Because for me, I dissect these movies so much and I can always look at the acting or look at the editing or something and take something from any project. But I actually don't think I'm alone in that. You don't have to be insane about acting like I am to appreciate anything that you see and anything you take in. I think it gives us a little bit more. Look, you've already spent the time on the money. You've already spent the time on the movie. Why not try to find something to take from that movie that you enjoyed? Maybe you didn't.
Absolutely.
Maybe you didn't like Ishtar, but you like Dustin Hoffman's performance.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. There are plenty of things that you could take even from a bad movie that you can suggest or enjoy. I think this is part of that what we'll get from this.
100%, man. 100%.
It's a great choice, brother. Great choice.
Yeah, glad. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. Be sure to check that one out, everybody. And stick around. We'll be coming back and we'll digress into another movie coming up on Director's Cut. Welcome back to Director's Cut with Seth and James. So I digress. Our kind of episode of that.
Yeah.
We've been featuring some great movies here, and it's something we're going to do going forward with this. Whenever we don't have guests, Seth and I will get together. Maybe we'll bring in a guest, maybe one of you, to talk about a movie, talk about some movies that maybe are a little more niche, a little more hidden out there and everything. And Seth chose a great one, the great director, great actor. I cannot top that, but I did want to my first movie choice to be a Robin Williams movie.
Yeah, makes sense.
In part because, obviously, if you've heard me talk for 2 seconds, you know what the man meant to me.
Right.
But I also think that there is so much of his work that was not noticed and unappreciated. Robin did a lot of projects, did a lot of movies, and was, for every movie that is well-known, like A Good Morning Vietnam or something, there are movies that came out around that time that people, you know, just because they got lost in the shuffle,
right,
didn't maybe do well box office-wise or weren't marketed well, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a couple of examples of his. I think Toys is a great example. Not a fantastic movie, maybe, but his performance, the performances of other actors in that movie, makes it a must-see to me in many ways.
Right.
But my number one movie of his, as far as if you haven't seen, I encourage you to check out. While I'd love you to see him in a 1 hour photo. 1 hour photo is one of the most disturbing movies you'll ever see. But it's a chance to see Robin like you've never seen him before. Not only in his acting, but even in his look. His look, you don't even recognize him in it.
No.
It's such an iconic performance.
It's a transformation, really. Yeah.
It's one of the greatest. It's technically a horror movie in many ways.
Yeah.
But it's not. There is no blood and guts.
Right.
There's no gore in that movie.
It's a psychological horror movie, I guess you could call it. Yeah.
That movie messed with me more than any blood and guts movie I've ever seen in my life. It brought me back to go. I actually went and watched a bunch of Hitchcock afterwards because of how much it was like that to me.
Ooh.
Where Hitchcock didn't need to scare you with blood and guts and everything. He got in your head.
Ratchet up the tension, yeah.
The Fisher King is my choice from 1991, a fantasy comedy directed by the amazing Terry Gilliam, directed by Richard Gravenis, another great writer, great director, great team right there. Stars Robin Williams and Jeff Bridges, Mercedes Rule, Amanda Plummer, and the wonderful Michael Jeter. Who I didn't get to mention earlier. The film tells the story of a radio shock jock who tries to find redemption by helping a man whose life he inadvertently shattered. What happens in this movie, just giving you a little quick synopsis, Jack Lucas, a narcissistic, misogynistic shock jock, becomes suicidal and despondent when he learns that some of his intense on-air comments inadvertently prompted a mentally unstable regular caller to commit a mass murder suicide. This disturbs him, obviously, and we see this happen, and then we meet Jack 3 years later, where he is working for his girlfriend, Mercedes Rule, at a video rental store, just to show you the datedness of this and everything. It's fantastic. I love that part of it, actually. The nostalgia of that part is fantastic. He is on a bender. He has a problem with alcohol, Jack. He's on a bender, and some kids mistake him for a homeless person and try to set him on fire.
Aye.
Robin's character, Perry, comes in to the rescue and saves him. And Perry and Jack develop a relationship. And Jack, while certainly wanting to, caring about Perry a little bit, sees redemption in Perry. Sees, I can redeem myself. I can help this man out. I can bring him up from the trash, and I can dust him off and make him a great human in society and all these things, and that will redeem me. That will, whether to the masses or not, to himself it will redeem. Because like a true narcissist, he does not truly care necessarily about Perry or about his girlfriend or any of these things. It's more so about, I can redeem myself through Perry. And one of the beautiful things that I think develops throughout this movie is the idea that Perry has some mental problems and struggling with mental health, but Perry is fine. Perry doesn't need to be dusted off. The person that needs to be dusted off is Jack.
Right.
And you get a lot of that through this movie. It's a beautifully well-told film. There are some moments in this film that are my all-time favorite moments of Robin on screen. There is a scene with Amanda. They dust him off, and he has this girl that he likes, and they go on a double date. And they are walking through the streets of Manhattan, and Robin is picking up trash. Because he's homeless, and they're trying to convince him, stop it, stop picking up the trash, stop doing that and everything, because he's on a date and he wants to impress Amanda Plummer's character.
Right.
Where they're talking and they start talking about novels and movie and TV in books that they like. And Amanda Plummer says something about these novels being trashy. And Robin says to her, I don't think there's anything trashy about romance. and he starts talking about it and everything. And at one point he says, besides, you can find the most beautiful things, and you just never know what you can find in the trash. And he holds to her this little wooden chair. And Amanda Plummer is such a good actor, and another one of these character actors that we touched on with Bill Cobbs and such. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to get the credit that she deserves. Her facial expressions. Amanda Plummer didn't have to deliver a line for you to know what her character was thinking.
Yep.
And I love actors like that. I think Absolutely. There's such a power in that.
Yep.
Her look on her face when she sees what's in Robin's hand is just only it's not topped. It's only complimented by Robin's look when he sees her look.
Oh, wow.
And that was all one take, one scene. Mm. And it was not planned. It was something that Terry kind of gave the freedom to the actors to be able to do these things. And it's just a beautiful scene. I want us to be Great. Able to play that for everybody here, just yep. to hear the audio of that. And even in the audio, you can hear the pause, and you can imagine, if you haven't seen the film, the looks on their faces.
Right.
Boy, that sounds real exciting.
It's not exciting at all.
Why not? Your calculations determine whether a book is published or not. It's a book that changes the way people think or, you know, act.
But what we publish is mostly trashy romance novels.
Don't say that. There's nothing trashy about romance. In romance is passion, it's imagination, it's beauty. Besides, you find some pretty wonderful things in the trash.
Just an amazing scene. Just a wonderful
very
scene.
Cool, very
and I
cool.
appreciate you putting that in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, no problem.
One of the things that I thought would be fun about this, because I think that this movie is maybe a little more popular than the one you suggested and a little more current.
It's definitely more mainstream, to be sure. But yeah, I think so.
So I didn't know getting into a whole lot of things about it that you already know out there. So I thought I did some homework on this and mm-hmm. wanted to get into some of the things that might not have been known about the film.
Oh, cool.
Jack wasn't a shock jock originally. That was just done in the final draft. Rain Man came out, and immediately everybody was afraid of being another Rain Man. They didn't want to try to copy that. They were parody is such done such in
right, yeah, imitation. You know, anything the old saying, anything in Hollywood, anything worth doing is worth overdoing, right? Yeah,
right. So. Well, for every director and actor that wants to do that and parodize something else, there are the other groups like Terry Gilliam and that want to. Oh God, I don't want to do anything like that. Mm. I want to do the exact opposite of that. Rain Man comes out as a huge hit. And while we are much better about this nowadays, most producers back then, you're dealing with mental health? I don't know about that.
Right.
Oh, I don't know if we want to do that. And then if you have a successful film that deals with mental health and then another one coming out that's similar to that project, you're very afraid of that. So they were trying to find different ways to separate from those things. Also, how this is the beginning of the rise of Howard Stern. And I think that while there was a touch of that in here, they didn't want to... They wanted to hit on that and kind of make a note of that, but they didn't want to copy Howard Stern. So there was some of that going on as
right.
well. But that's an interesting part of this, I thought. The movie was promised to James Cameron and Billy Crystal. That was the original director writer of it.
That'd be a very different film. Wow.
James Cameron's a fine director, but not for this project and not for projects that involve thinking. I'm sorry. But if you go to a James Cameron movie, you're gonna have some plot,
yeah.
but you're gonna have a lot of special effects. You're gonna have a lot of those.
It's gonna look interesting. You're right. He's not really interested in a lot of deeper stuff than that.
Very yeah. successful director. I am not at all taking anything
of course,
from him.
Yes.
I just think that he's not the right guy for certain projects.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never felt this before, but any Robin Williams movie he did, he owned for me. I can't imagine anybody else in those roles. Billy Crystal never really got a chance to do really serious work a lot.
He never did.
Interestingly, his career started that way. Soap, his character on Soap was supposed to be a bit of a more dramatic character.
Mm.
It's one of the first homosexual characters in TV and
right,
a popular TV
and more
show
mainstream,
and that.
Yep.
And Billy wanted to play that a little more serious than tongue in cheek. As it would turn out, the director and him not having a lot of clout as a young director,
right.
he kind of had to do certain things certain ways and parodizing and a lot of that. But his original concept of Soap was more serious. That character mm-hmm. was more serious. And he would go on to try to do more serious. Interestingly, City Slickers was supposed to be more of a serious role for him.
Really?
That ended up going a little bit more silly
more
and everything.
Wise, yeah.
Because it was Billy Crystal. And directors, not directors so much, but producers were very afraid of letting Billy Crystal do anything that wasn't, comedic.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't his in his silly wheelhouse, right?
So that was never going to work. And in part two, Disney, who did this, was very afraid of releasing this movie. They thought it was way too dark. It was way too serious. Kind of funny to look at where they are now in projects to think that Disney, you know, would
right,
worry about
right.
that.
It was a different time, right?
It really was a different time. Mercedes Ruehl thought that she bored Terry Gilliam to death and never thought that she would ever get this role.
Oh, no.
Terry Gilliam turned around and told her, no, you're going to get nominated for a Best Supporting Actor for this role. Like,
yep,
that's how good
right.
you were. Ruehl won a Best Supporting Actress Oscar for her performance.
Yes.
It's just
well deserved, by the way.
So interesting to think of that. That happens so often.
It does. It's like,
I think I can think of off the top of my head some of the best auditions I've ever had, but I didn't get the role. But yet roles like the one where we met, Sherlock, there are a few roles I wanted more in my life than playing Sherlock Holmes. And I would say one of my top 10 worst auditions ever was for that one. And I was as shocked as anybody I got the role, to be honest with you. It's one of those things that happens sometimes.
Right.
This is where you really do trust directors.
Mm-hmm.
They see something, and even if it's a bad audition, you gave them something that they were like, yeah, that you're the one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's where really good directors come in, I think.
Right. And Terry Gilliam is a very fine director. I mean, he's idiosyncratic, you know, the projects he's chosen over the years, and some hits, some misses, that kind of thing. But as a craftsman, I mean, he's second to none.
I would put Terry in my top 10 directors of all time.
Wow, yeah.
I love his work. I love his chances. Even movies like the Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is not a great movie or anything.
No,
but
it's awesome, though.
Look at the things that he did in that movie
mm-hmm.
that directors are doing now consistently,
mm-hmm.
that he was taking chances at that
yep.
now are kind of almost intertwined into the craft making of mm-hmm. film and everything. I really feel like he's one of those guys. I hate saying this, but he's not going to get appreciated completely until he's gone.
That's true.
Then they
look back at his oeuvre and they'll be like, wow, this guy was really good.
It's part of the reason why you and I like to do these things where we do talk about these directors or actors a lot is because we want to highlight them while they're around.
Yeah. Credit where credit's due. Yeah.
Another thing that one of the things that was so good about Terry Gilliam is the way he sees the world and how much he wanted this movie to have a fairy tale imagery.
Mm.
He really wanted to give you what it is like to be in the head of Robin's character, Perry.
That leads me actually to a question. I don't know if you know the answer to this or not. So the title of the film is The Fisher King, which is related to the quest for the Grail, the King Arthur Knights of the Round Table quest for the Grail. The Fisher King is the one, I believe, who keeps the Grail.
Yes.
And that's who they have to get past in order to get to it. So how does that play into the film itself?
Terry's character, Perry, is on the hunt for the Holy Grail.
Oh, okay.
And his nemesis is the Red Knight. And defeating the Red Knight. In fact, you just set me up perfectly, brother.
Oh,
nicely done. Because you see the movie, and the Red Knight, Terry Gilliam does a great job of the shadows and smog, fog and everything. But it was made of latex, foam latex, to the point where they actually had to ask Robin to hold back because he went too hard on it. He went too crazy. Like, we need that again. You got to do other takes and stuff. Terry Gilliam actually had to multiple times during the filming talk to Robin Williams and settle him down. Quote, the last shot we had to do was Robin running at the end of this scene towards the end where he's running in Manhattan naked. It's one of my favorite scenes of all time. And he's in this hysterical state. You can even see the light ever so slightly beginning to come on the river in the background. But Robin was so angry because it was such a crucial moment that he felt he'd been cheated of his ability to really give this moment his all.
Oh, wow.
You don't see much of Robin but his back of this. But it was important for him to really give you the fury of this. And he worked so hard that he, like picturing what people would see from behind him and directing mm-hmm. and acting this and stuff. Robin Williams, not for nothing, was a great director that never got a chance to direct.
He did. I think he directed a couple of movies, but
yeah.
they weren't big. They were like very small projects, yeah.
Again, one of these things that he really wasn't given the opportunity
what could have been,
to do
right?
and everything.
Yeah.
But he was so, such a, the, while the tape is rolling, I am that character, and I am completely embodied into it. And while I don't think many people would ever say that he wasn't a great director or mm-hmm. a great actor, mm-hmm. I don't think people realize how intense of an actor he was and how embedded he was in these characters, especially when we consider him as such a comedic genius and everything.
Right, yeah.
Williams had to get the comedy out of his system to that point. Williams went up and up to uptown to do a set, in his words, to get the comedy out of his system. Gilliam, Bridges, his brother Bo, and a shocked audience watched Robin Williams for 45 minutes do stand-up that he had not prepared to do.
Oh, my gosh.
And the club owner didn't know this was going to happen.
Oh, my gosh.
They get there on day one of filming, and they're doing this, and everybody's liking what Robin's doing except for Robin. And he's like, I got to get the comedy out of me. I got to get the comedy out of me. And he leaves set. Doesn't tell anybody. Just leaves set. And ends up having somebody from the bar come by and tell them, hey, I'm going to be – Robin's performing a set over here, you guys. And this audience, what I would give for a time machine to go back and sit in that set.
Oh, my gosh.
I got goosebumps right
Man,
now thinking about
that. Man, wasting a time
that.
Machine. That's our other podcast, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, other podcast. I did want to mention as well how hairy Robin was. And this is well known about Robin Williams and everything.
Bear.
But at this time, it's not as well known. And in this scene, Robin is naked and everything. And Terry Gilliam was deathly afraid. I mean deathly afraid, more than he was on any project he has ever worked on, as far as going over budget or did I pick the right actor for this role, anything. He was so afraid of killing Robin's career.
Wow.
He was. He actually tried to convince Robin and Jeff to not do the scene naked because of how hairy Robin was. And he thought he would lose fans because of his naked body and too much hair on it. And he thought it would actually hurt his career. To which Robin said, I'll take it.
Wow.
Whatever happens, I'll take it. It's too important for the film.
Wow.
It actually got in his head a little bit because he wasn't worried about this until Terry started worrying about it. And funnily enough, Jeff Bridges, very handsome man, starts worrying about this for the first time in his career. He's never worried about it before. But obviously they go through with the scene. Spoiler alert, didn't kill Robin's career.
No, or Jeff Bridges for that matter.
No, but it did create one of the better scenes in, I think, TV history, or movie history.
Right.
And they had to block off a Central Park for this. One of the few times that had been done, really. It's an iconic scene done perfectly by one of the greatest actors of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool.
It's a fun movie. It may not do the greatest job of a movie ever has on mental health, it is an early telling tale of mental health and where we are today. And it is ahead of its time in the way in taking on this subject matter and handling it with care and comedy like only Terry and Robin could do.
Right, right. And it's, obviously, and it's a movie I have not seen, but I have, from what you've told me and what I've heard, I've kind of read the plot synopsis and everything. It's a movie about just broken people.
Yeah.
Just about everyone is broken in some way. And how do you navigate that? How do you get through, this part of your life, that kind of thing? And the people you meet along the way. And so you find out how much, broken they are. And it's like, oh, gosh, I'm not in this alone, kind of thing. And how you can build each other up, how you can be that person, strangely enough, can be that person that can help the other person.
Well said. Very well said. We have to wrap the episode up because I'm literally tearing up just because I had one of the scenes playing while we were talking.
No.
And I don't know why I did that. I should not have done that.
No, it's all right.
That was not a good idea on my part. It is a good idea on you to not only check out these movies.
Yeah.
Let us know your suggestions. Let us know if you are an artist, if you're a creative out there and you want to be on the show, reach out to us. We encourage you to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly to spread the word about this show in particular.
Yes.
But all of our original content here at Civic Media. While Seth and I are trying to give attention to some of these great movies that we think, we appreciate you doing that with our shows. Thank you so much for supporting the work we're doing here, everybody. We'll be back with a new director's cut for you coming up next week right here at WFHR Locally Grown Radio.